It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this week, highly pathogenic avian influenza or bird flu was found in a Racine backyard chicken flock. It's the latest in a string of cases, including a large commercial flock in Jefferson County and wild birds, including a whooping crane. Right now, bird flu has not spread to Wisconsin cows as it has in 18 other states, the most recent in Idaho, but the disease is still a big concern for the poultry industry. As a response, Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection called off poultry shows for the rest of the year in several counties, and Wisconsin is pushing for a better adherence to biosecurity measures to keep local flocks safe. In just a bit, we'll hear from a hatchery owner in Beaver Dam. First, we talk to Dr. Darlene Conkle, state veterinarian and Wisconsin's chief animal health officer at the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Dr. Conkle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me this morning.
What are the latest measures here for keeping flocks safe from avian flu in Wisconsin?
Well, the main measures relate to biosecurity, and biosecurity is just a general term that involves taking lots of measures to keep disease out of a herd or a flock. So we're really encouraging flock owners in the state and livestock owners in general to keep good biosecurity practices in place. Some of those can be really simple, like washing hands and keeping equipment clean, all the way up to some more complicated measures like having employees shower in and out. And we do have lots of information on our website on biosecurity.
What is it about this disease that makes it so dangerous? It seems like it spreads quickly, it's very lethal, and it affects different bird species. What's the deal with this virus?
This highly pathogenic avian influenza virus that we're dealing with is H5N1, and it came to North America late in 2021. So we've been dealing with this virus now for quite a while. It is highly pathogenic and highly fatal to domestic chickens, turkeys, domestic poultry, and it also affects wild birds, as you mentioned. And it does spread rapidly from bird to bird, and it can persist in the environment in some cases. So again, we're just asking people to be aware of the conditions, the situation, and to employ good biosecurity measures.
People may remember past outbreaks leading, among other things, to very high egg prices. How does our current status with avian flu in poultry in Wisconsin compare to some of the peaks we've seen in the state and the country in the last few years?
Right now, we're not at the peaks we were last year. We've seen an uptick in cases across the country, particularly in the northern tier of states in the past few weeks. And of course, we're going into the fall season, which is peak migration for a lot of wild waterfowl. So both state veterinarians and federal veterinarians are watching the situation closely. And, hoping that we don't have as many cases as we had last year. And again, those biosecurity measures help both commercial and backyard flocks keep the virus out.
A big concern, of course, is the risk of spread to dairy cows. We've seen this elsewhere in the country. As far as I know, no reported cases in Wisconsin yet. It seems to spread more slowly and be less hazardous for dairy cows. That said, what are we doing to watch out for that here?
Well, we're asking all livestock producers, but in particular poultry producers and dairy producers, to watch their herds and flocks closely and report any signs that might be consistent with avian influenza or with H5N1 to their veterinarian and to us. We have information on our website about how to do that. And as you mentioned, we have not seen any cases in dairy in Wisconsin. We've been doing a comprehensive surveillance plan, the National Milk Testing Strategy, over the past months. And we've got quite a few tests out there. All have been not detected for avian influenza. So,
for people out there who are raising poultry, whether that's 3 chickens in their backyard or 300,000 chickens in their commercial operation, what are the resources out there where that they can get the information they need to keep their birds safe?
Mm-hmm. Our DACCAP website, datcp.wi.gov, is a great one-stop resource for both commercial and backyard flock owners. We have lots of tips on biosecurity. We link to lots of other resources from USDA and elsewhere. So people should be able to get a really good sense of what they can be doing on their own operations and in their own flocks to keep up good biosecurity.
And what are people watching for to say, uh-oh, this chicken could be infected? What are some of the signs that should be red flags?
Red flags would be any respiratory signs, sneezing, snicking, drop in egg production, drop in feed and water intake. Often with highly pathogenic avian influenza, what flock owners will see is sudden death loss in their birds.
Dr. Conkle, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks again for having me.
That's Dr. Darlene Conkle, state veterinarian and Wisconsin's chief animal health officer at the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We talked about the most recent cases of avian flu in Wisconsin and measures the state is taking. Now we turn to Nick Levendusky, owner of Sunnyside Hatchery in Beaver Dam. He's president of the Wisconsin Poultry and Egg Industries Association. Nick, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start with your operation at the hatchery. Tell us a little bit about the hatchery, how your work differs from what someone might think of as a typical chicken farm.
Well, there's a lot of things different at the hatchery versus a typical chicken farm. For one, this time of year, we're a very seasonal operation. We do hatch out birds or chicks 52 weeks a year, but right now is certainly our the lowest amount of volume that we're hatching out. There's not a great amount of demand for backyard fowl this time of year. But we're already, we've got our sights set on the spring when we really got to start ramping up for the folks that want to get their baby chicks, for Easter time and, their traditional meat birds for next spring. So so we're kind of gearing up for that. But, fortunately for us, like Dr. Conkle had mentioned, increased awareness of what's going on, communicating with our offsite breeder flocks. The managers that, it's important to up the biosecurity awareness because, it might not be right on our back door, but, it's within our state. A couple farms have been affected, certainly in the wild bird populations. So we got to up the ante a little bit here and just be operated a little bit more heightened awareness.
On a practical level, on a practical level, what does biosecurity mean? What kind of measures are you having to take above and beyond what you're usually doing?
A lot of our farmers that work with us to breed the birds are Amish folks. So, it's just driving home the importance. It's not advised to, visit your neighbor's chicken operation. It's not, certainly there's no exchanging of birds between one premise to another. And also, having the hatchery breeder flocks, our guys are not to have, backyard poultry of their own. There's just too much of a vulnerability there having backyard birds and then, doing the daily chores and stuff in the breeder flocks. So it's just it's just about increasing the awareness for people so they ramp things up. But we also do like all in, all out on these flocks. So we birds stay in production for a little over a year, and then we get rid of that flock and then we start with a brand new flock, every year or so. So we don't have older birds communicating with younger birds, any types of diseases. It's all in, all out. And then just heightened levels of, having dip pans, with bleach at doorways and stuff like that. But all those, areas, certainly are heightened more so than they have in the past. And especially the last, five or six years when avian influenza, became a real issue versus, a theoretical one.
For the backyard chicken coop owners that you work with, we saw at least one positive case in a Racine backyard flock. There's concerns that wild birds might spread the disease to domestic birds. What do you tell your customers, maybe who are newer to keeping poultry? What kind of advice do you have for them to prevent avian flu?
Well, I mean, the main thing is just to keep the interaction between wild birds and their domestic birds at a minimum. I mean, that's the biggest one. And then, like Dr. Conkle had mentioned too, have a heightened awareness, but also understand that birds go through, seasonally they have, mild colds, they do have some mild respiratory issues associated with backyard flocks, but certainly, if you see if you see your birds not eating, egg production's, you know, falling off the wagon, and certainly like unexpected higher than normal mortality, like get on the phone with DADCAP, call your veterinarian, let's get the wheels in motion, because, you know, it's important to get that communicated out so you're not putting anybody else's flocks at risk.
If you can switch hats for a moment to your role with the Wisconsin Poultry and Egg Industries Association, what is your sense from members of that organization? Are they walking on eggshells watching for the next outbreak here in the state?
We've grown a bit accustomed to these flare-ups, certainly. And like Dr. Conkle mentioned, you know, it always seems to coincide with, you know, with either birds migrating to, you know, in the spring or from, you know, or through Wisconsin in the fall, you know, where we're seeing the commercial operations becoming affected. So it's just becoming more of a concern. Like I'd mentioned it before, it was more of a theoretical, let's, you know, try to keep that out of our flocks. And now we're seeing, you know, even with these increased biosecurity measures, you know, there still are commercial flocks that are vulnerable. You know, you still have employees that, you know, can, you know, bring in the virus on their boots or, you know, through air ducts or, I mean, there's a lot of different vectors, you know, that, that you have minimal control over as well. And, I guess we're just growing accustomed to, you know, reacting, you know, when it hits, but, I think it's just kind of becoming like the new normal.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me and have a great day.
You too. That's Nick Levandusky, owner of Sunnyside Hatchery and Beaver Dam, president of the Wisconsin Poultry and Egg Industries Association. Learned how avian flu is affecting the local poultry industry. Earlier, we heard from state veterinarian Dr. Darlene Conkle about cases in Wisconsin and what the state is doing to combat the disease. Coming up, a Wisconsin study looked at school districts that changed to a performance pay system for teachers and why a lot of them switched back.
The systems were more complicated. They were more complicated both on the teacher side to kind of track, you know, the various points. They were complicated for administrators.
Performance pay in schools next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin schools are seeing a greater need for speech therapists for the state's youngest children. Educators believe this could be because, in part, of an excessive use of screen time for kids and their caregivers. Corrine Hess has more.
Elizabeth Chandler is seated at a crescent-shaped table at the end of a brightly lit hallway at Bridges Elementary School in Prairie du Sac. On this school morning, she's working with two boys in pre-kindergarten on R sounds.
You colored it blue, but the R word was gray. We're going to growl like a dog.
Gray.
The lesson continues as they growl and grin over and over.
We're going to growl again. Ready? Grin. Grin. Yeah, that tongue stays down.
As a speech pathologist, Chandler has used exercises like this for years. But she's finding more and more children are in need of help. The Sauk Prairie School District has seen a significant increase in referrals for speech and language services for the community's youngest children. Just since 2023, the number of kids in pre-kindergarten through K-4 who are receiving speech-language services has gone from 15 to 28. That's an 86% jump. Superintendent Jeff Wright believes the amount of time children and their caregivers are spending on screens is leading to the increase. Wright says when adults are looking down at a screen, children can't see their full face, and seeing their grown-ups speak is crucial for young children to learn language.
When I look into a baby's eyes and go, goo, goo, ga, ga, and the baby makes those sounds back, that child is learning how to make that hard G sound with me. But you can't learn that through a screen.
The American Academy of Pediatrics defines screen time as any time spent interacting with digital devices, including smartphones, tablets, computers, and televisions. For children aged 2 to 5 years, they say screen time should be limited to 1 hour per day of high-quality educational programming, and they say children younger than 2 shouldn't be on a screen. Dawn Mirth Johnson is a speech-language educational consultant with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. She says adults should also be aware of how often they're on their screens.
A typical guide for adults when they're using digital devices is, would I read a book right now? So if I'm sitting here reading a book, I'm not going to interact with you language-wise.
Mirth Johnson says while she understands the attraction of distracting kids with screens, it can have a negative impact. A 2023 study from the American Medical Association of Pediatrics found that the more hours a toddler is exposed to a screen, the more likely they are to have developmental delays.
Parental tech use has been likened to secondhand smoke in that it might endanger children's health and development in ways we don't even fully understand yet.
While Chandler works with the young boys on grrr sounds in the hallway, a few of her colleagues are in the 4-year-old kindergarten classroom. Speech therapist Anna Bina is talking with a young boy about the trucks on his family farm.
Oh, so you have 2 sizes of diesel trucks at your farm.
We come home and dump the gravel out sometimes like that.
Bina corrects him gently when he says the trucks dump out devil instead of gravel.
When your house needs some gravel at it, he comes home and dumps it.
And dumps it on the devil.
These conversations about trucks seem simple, but it's what speech therapists call joint attention. Bina says talking about shared activities is critical for language growth.
When children are only getting the one side from a screen, it's different. It's more passive than engaged.
The speech therapists all agree that creating games at home is a lot harder than using a screen while trying to make dinner. They suggest caregivers narrate what they're doing for their children so speech becomes an ongoing part of daily life. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today. School districts in the state have largely turned away from performance-based pay for teachers over the past dozen years. That's according to a recent study by UW-Madison education researchers. In 2014, nearly half of all school districts had some kind of performance-based pay incentive program for teachers. The study found that dropped to 12% last year. Other states have experimented with performance pay. In the early 2000s, Denver, Colorado's professional compensation system was considered a model for getting districts away from traditional pay structures for teachers. But it became the center of a teacher's strike in 2019 over the question of pay for performance. We're joined now by the Wisconsin Report's lead author and a Denver public schools educator. Steve Kimball is co-director of the Wisconsin Evaluation Collaborative at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research at UW-Madison. And Robert Gold is a special education teacher and president of the Denver Classroom Teachers Association. They talked to Kate Archer Kent earlier this week.
Steve, starting with you, can you explain the concept of performance-based pay for teachers and what that system has typically looked like here in Wisconsin?
Well, performance pay for teachers can go in a number of different forms. In the past, it was commonly referred to as merit pay. But essentially, it boils down to rewarding teaching practice and related outcomes, either through bonuses or potentially base pay increases. So it's either determined by a measure of teaching practice or by the student outcomes the teacher produces, or in some cases, school-wide performance.
And would that be like standardized test outcomes?
It can be, certainly, and it can be determined, by other potential sources of assessments. And there's different ways to measure using the standardized tests as well, which can get into a number of different issues there as well.
And Robert, ProComp, short for professional compensation, and in Denver schools, it was pitched to teachers as this opportunity for greater personal earnings. What has Denver learned from its merit pay system?
Oh, we've learned a lot. It really started out as this idea that teachers could continue to earn, base salary over time. And of course, with political winds and other things that are happening, that's not what happened. And so our ProComp system, we're in the third iteration of it now, which seems to be more sustainable. But we've actually incorporated many of the other things, like the lessons we've learned over time, and we're back to more traditional, a more traditional system, but still with some components.
Okay, so what does a traditional system mean? What might that look like?
Yeah, so a lot of teacher schedules, salaries, they're based off of what's called a step lane schedule, and ProComp really, that changed that step lane schedule. It was when it was first devised, it was actually studied with the Denver Teachers Union as well as DPS, and there were four different pieces to it. There were knowledge and skills, professional evaluation, market incentives, and student growth. And within those pieces, you would earn different parts of it. Now, that system that was originally created was really meant to, we had a different funding mechanism for it, and it was meant to grow over time. But then we changed that system in 2008 to a higher bonus system, mainly because of the political winds that were affecting Denver at the time. There was a lot of school reform, ideas that came into Denver that influenced that. And at the end of the day, it actually ended up hurting our students more than actually helping them. The issue was that those top performing and high growth schools, there was a 96% overlap on those. And generally, when you had exceeded expectations, you saw that those expectations exceed within those higher socioeconomic and higher, according to test scores, performing schools. And so we saw many of our educators that actually would, our veteran educators would know that they could get a higher bonus by moving to these higher performing schools, which left a gap within our more impacted schools where we were filling with new teachers. We went from a 10% turnover rate to, at the height of it, about a 20% turnover rate in Denver.
Steve, over to you. We're hearing about how potentially in Denver, it could harm high-risk students, high-risk areas. You found in your research that Wisconsin school districts largely abandoned performance-based pay incentives for teachers. What has happened over the years?
Performance pay, a lot of districts wanted to implement performance pay, but it was back in 2014-15, but it was nothing like what was described about the ProComp model back when that was structured. And the conditions under which they were created were a lot different too. Hmm. We did not have the unions negotiating the changes back then. So this was the district leaders with, teacher representation. Most of them had some sort of a transition team to work through them. And they designed pay structures of various forms. So what we found first is they look different in the different places we talked to. And the use of performance pay was not, used in all of the districts. And there were various forms of performance pay used by those that did implement them. But what we found and what you asked is most of those districts moved back more towards a traditional salary schedule, though none went back to like the full standard traditional salary schedule with all the different lanes. Most went back to experience-based with some other elements included in it. So, yeah, we did see kind of a retraction or movement back towards more of a traditional salary structure type approach.
In the districts you were able to talk to, what was the feedback for what was, upholding those decisions to revert back to a more experience-based system for teacher pay?
So there were several reasons, and we kind of pulled out the common elements to them. And one was, the new systems that incorporated performance pay in addition to some other structures, career ladders, point progression type systems. So there's a number of different structures that they put into place. But commonly among the changes and the reasons cited for going back to a more traditional approach was that the systems were more complicated. They were more complicated both on the teacher side to kind of track, you know, the various points or ways that they need to accumulate experiences to then put forward as a reason for a pay increase. They were complicated for administrators to manage the system and to make determinations.
We're talking about performance-based pay for teachers and how a recent study shows Wisconsin schools are largely rejecting such a pay system. Steve Kimball is co-director of the Wisconsin Evaluation Collaborative. That's in UW-Madison School of Education. And Robert Gould is here, a special education teacher and president of the Denver Classroom Teachers Association. Robert, have any of those issues come up, that a system like this is complex, that you want to reward all teachers and lift them up, and other, you know, other types of things like morale? What impact has that had in Denver?
Oh, absolutely. Everything that Dave was describing, it was flashbacks for me because, you know, we actually didn't change our system until 2019, until our Denver teacher strike. And it was one of the reasons we went to that was because we had been pleading with the district to say, hey, we need to change the system. It's not making sense. Literally, teachers were not able to even understand how their pay was created. I mean, you would, and every single person had a different reasoning behind their pay. You if you tried to figure out why you were paid what you were being paid, you would have to go back through this long, complex search to try to figure out how your pay was built over time. And I think also teachers are frustrated because those increases in the base pay didn't keep up with inflation. And really, even with a small cost of living increases that we were getting, it wasn't enough to continue to be competitive, right? So that idea of being complicated, it was very true. I mean, that was one of the things that teachers identified the most.
So I'm just sitting here wondering, how do charter schools fit into the ProComp story?
Yeah, so it was really interesting. So as I mentioned here in Denver, we've had a history of reform, educational reform that really was pushed in. You know, you'll see in a lot of different states, and we've seen it here in Colorado. There was these idea of vouchers that came in or other things, but we had a massive increase in our charter, the number of charter schools in Denver. And at that time, this reform ideas that we're living, that's what really made the changes in our ProComp, in our system, our 2.0 is what we call it, in 2008. Mm-hmm. In fact, when we were arguing in 2008 with the administration saying, the changes you are going to make are going to be harmful for kids down the line, you know, they basically said, either you take our changes or we're not going to renew your agreement. And so we decided, okay, well, let's move with this. Let's try to move through the system and look at it. And what can we do to make sure that we still have a voice in this? But over that time period, it was not just the pay for performance system. It was the way that we rated schools. And so schools would get closed, you know, if they had these lower test scores, and then they would put a charter school in their place. And we saw this mass expansion of charter schools in Denver because of this. And guess what? Spoiler alert, they weren't any better at supporting kids than the traditional school.
Do you look at, you know, some districts experimenting with rewarding, you know, teachers who acquire new certificates or new skills associated with their teaching? Like, has that been a trend at all?
Yes. So a number of districts did implement some forms of knowledge and skill-based pay. But a number of those, like with the other elements, kind of walked back from that. In some cases, they had those in what we termed as point progression systems, where you would have to pursue certain, you know, district would kind of cultivate or select different professional development experiences that they wanted their teachers to pursue. And once those were completed, those would go into a certain number of points. In some cases, it was demonstrating teacher leadership or leading a professional development session. So those types of approaches did go on the decline in our follow-up study. But most districts that had an element of knowledge and skill pay still rewarded for teachers for obtaining national board certification. That was probably the most common form. But other than that, it's fairly limited.
Robert, I want to give you final words here. Are Denver schools better off for ProComp?
I think as we're coming into this new iteration, yes. And so one of the things in this 3.0, we've gone back to a salary schedule, but we've kept, you know, certain pieces that that we had to have that were A, working for kids, right, for educators and kids. As Steve mentioned, like there are professional development units. These are classes that are actually created by educators and or supported by the district that actually makes sense. Like I'll give an example. We recently did a report. It's called the La Raza Report here in Denver, where it talked about the supports and how our Hispanic and Latino, Latinx students are doing in Denver. And we had a couple of our members that actually came together and they created a professional development unit on what we can do to support those students more.
Well, Robert and Steve, thank you so much for your insights on this issue.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. It's an important issue. It's not just our educators, it's our students at the end of the day that need this support.
Robert Gold is president of the Denver Classroom Teachers Association. Steve Kimball co-directs the Wisconsin Evaluation Collaborative at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research. They talked to Kate Archer-Kent about performance-based pay incentives for teachers. A recent study shows how Wisconsin districts are largely moving away from that pay model in recent years. Coming up, wildlife enforcement agents use robotic decoys to catch poachers in the act. Meet a taxidermist from Mosinee who builds these lifelike hunting decoys.
A lot of poachers are using thermal scopes. Now this one will actually, it heats up and puts out a signature, so it looks like a real deer out there.
That's coming up here on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Sarah Hopeful with a story about reflecting on nature deep in the woods.
Forestry offers a unique glimpse into the natural beauty and evolving landscape of Wisconsin. Writer Ron Weber, a forester himself, reflects on the tracks we leave in the woods and what that can teach us about wildlife restoration and the legacy of conservation work.
One of the great things about being a forester is we get to see so many of the wild places and things that make Wisconsin such a wonderful place to live and work. Sometimes those sights trigger thoughts and feelings that go even deeper than just their beauty. Recently, while conducting a timber cruise to determine if the forest was in need of a harvest, I came upon a logging road which had been used on an adjacent harvest. I followed the road for a ways as it was going in the general direction I needed to continue my cruise. As I negotiated the ice-packed road, I noticed elk tracks crossing the road, entombed in ice, covered with a light skiff of snow. It struck me as a unique sight, so I pulled out my camera and snapped a couple of pictures. 50 yards further down the road, I noticed wolf tracks, similarly encased in ice. After taking a couple pictures of those also, I cut off the road to continue my cruise. A forester has much to think about on the journey from one plot to the next. Regeneration, quality and composition of overstory trees, invasive species, and how much of a hassle will it be for the logger to cross that stream? Along with these things, I also found myself thinking about those tracks. I grew up in what was for the most part a wolfless Wisconsin. Now they are quite common. Elk were no more than a footnote in the natural history of our state, but now I see their tracks often on the Flambeau River State Forest where I work. Even the two bald eagles I had seen along the river earlier in the day were a rarity at one time in my life, but now are so common sometimes we rarely pause to notice them. I pulled out my camera and took another look at the pictures. It is said that a picture is worth 1,000 words. If that is the case, I was disappointed by the pictures, because I guess not even 1,000 words were enough to convey the beauty I saw in those tracks. I thought of all the people who dreamed of having those animals as part of our landscape again, and worked tirelessly to make it happen. I especially thought of retired DNR wolf biologists Dick Thiel and Adrian Weideman, and DNR elk biologist Lane Stoll. They had dedicated much of their careers and lives to making those dreams a reality. To see that come to fruition must be extremely satisfying. What about us as foresters? Sustainable forestry is a long-term investment. Most of us will never see the landscape pictures we are painting with the help of our logging partners. The tracks my boots have left in the snow, sand, and mud doing my work over the years will have long since faded. The shelterwood, coppice, and selection harvests we set up are often described as messes upon completion. And even 10 or 20 years later, only the most discerning eye would describe them as beautiful. I guess it is enough for me to know and believe that one day that beauty will be there for all to recognize. Maybe it will even be beautiful enough for someone to stop in their travels and take a picture. That thought lightened my feet a little on the journey to my next plot.
Ron Weber is a writer who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Sarah Hopeful.
You're listening to WPR News. In taxidermy, the final product is usually an animal specimen or hunting trophy that's stationary. But one taxidermist in Mosinee makes deer, elk, and wolves that move, even give off heat. He uses technology like remote control car parts to animate realistic-looking decoys. And wildlife enforcement officers use those decoys to catch poachers in the act. As poachers start to catch on, those decoys have to get better and better. It's a wildlife enforcement arms race. Brian Wolfslagle is the owner of Custom Robotic Wildlife, Inc. in Mosinee. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
Not a problem. Glad to be here.
Now, these decoys, talk us through, before the robot part of it entered the picture, what are wildlife officers doing with these decoys? How does that work?
They're putting them out on the sides of the road mostly during hunting season, trying to catch people shooting off the road or shooting at night. A lot of times people will spotlight and then shoot the deer because basically the deer don't move. So they're using them like that. Primitive years when we first started, I guess, some of them didn't move at all. Others we would put like a moving ear on it and put fishing line to its tail. So when its ear would twitch, its tail would move. But as time goes on, everybody catches on to things. And so we start advancing as well. And we started making the heads move and we make the legs move. We did all kinds of different things to them.
Now, the fact that you need to keep changing this, I could see maybe there's a category of poacher who's, doing it accidentally, right? Well, I didn't know the rules, whatever.
Right.
You got me. I won't do it again. Obviously, there are some people who are intentionally breaking the rules, right? If you need to keep making fancier decoys.
Absolutely. There's two different poachers. There's one that we'd call a professional poacher who's out there, hunting just for antlers. Shooting the animal, cutting the antlers off, selling them, whatever they do with them. And then, like you said, there's the guy that last day of the season, maybe everybody else at deer camp has a deer, and this one's kind of on the side of the road, and they make a mistake, an honest mistake. But most of the officers that I work with throughout the United States and Canada really are targeting these professional mm-hmm. poachers.
Yeah, how did you go from, I assume, local Wisconsin wildlife officials to... hey, you're on the radar across the country and beyond.
Very interesting question. So there's a group called the NAWEA, North American Wildlife Enforcement Officers Association. And there's an officer in Oregon at the time. His name was Galen Chandler. He got in contact with me and asked me to build him a robotic elk. And so he got us onto this NAWEA group. And so now ever since, pretty much every year, my family and I, or my daughters, we just got back from Pennsylvania a couple of weeks ago. The NAWEA was there. There was 700 officers. And that's where we go. And we kind of market and talk to the guys and the women and figure out what works, what doesn't work, what do they need. You know, I say we can build pretty much anything in a dry 70 degree shop with a cement floor. But what happens when there's twigs and rocks and uneven ground and 20 below weather?
Now, I haven't seen your handiwork close up, but you've got some videos on your website. If I came around the corner on a trail and saw, you know, your elk or your moose or whatever sitting there a little distance, and then mm-hmm. I saw it move like this, I mean, I'd probably think this is the real deal if I didn't go up and inspect it too closely. How realistic are you trying to make these?
We do try to do whatever, you know, the best way we can, obviously. You know, we do a lot of mounts for movies. TV commercials and movies as well. There's a couple of different companies that I work with right now, and they call me anytime that the producers are looking for some type of animal. We recently did a black wolf for a scene that was being filmed in Chicago, downtown Chicago. Obviously, they can't release a wolf down there to film, so they use ours, and then they piece in you know, real animals running around as well. But so yeah, they're real. I mean, you can't really tell the difference.
We're talking to Brian Wolfslagle from Mosinee, owner of Custom Robotic Wildlife, talking about his hunting decoys that help wildlife enforcement officers catch poachers in the act. Now, it seems to me one of the challenges here has got to be, you know, with taxidermy, usually it's sitting still, right? What has to go into making sure that, you know, it can move back and forth and still hold up? Or is that easy? I don't know.
The deer is actually one of the harder animals to do because deer hair has so many different colors to it. Throughout each deer, doing a black bear or like that black wolf is pretty simple because it's all black. So you don't see the lines as easy, but there are ones, you know, like the deer are tough sometimes. They'll see that line across the neck. Lately we've been working on one that, we call it the heat. It's a thermal deer. So it has heating pads in it. A lot of poachers are using thermal scopes and trying to, you know, they drive down the road and if it doesn't put out a heat signature, obviously they don't shoot it. So now this one will actually, it heats up and puts out a signature, so it looks like a real deer out there.
Now, you are kind of inventing your own technology, right? You don't go to the store and get the deer head moving motor. How do you improvise? Where do you go to get the gear and then fit it to your deer and elk and moose and so on?
Most of our stuff over the years is, a lot of it's RC car parts, things like that we use. But we create a lot of our own parts here. We have a milling machine and a lathe, and we make a lot of what we need to do. But it's based off of, you know, the technology of RC cars with a remote control. So these officers can sit a distance away and watch it and observe it and observe the poacher coming down the road and still move the deer. Some of them, we have swivel bases, so they actually turn. We used to do a track system. We don't do as many anymore. It just was tough for the officers to set up a track system again. It's back to, I can make it work on my cement floor, but putting a track system out in the wild is a little different because of all the ground and the twigs and uneven land. So
they've got some movement. They can put out some heat. I understand, at least in some cases, they can have droppings.
We messed around with one that had a little auger system, yeah, that lifted its tail up like it was dropping some brown M&Ms. So that worked for a little bit. It all depends on the officer, how much who they're trying to catch is one of the biggest ones. A lot of people think that these officers are just throwing these out there on the side of the road and hoping that some guy or woman drives down the road and shoots at it, and that's not the case at all. I would tell you from doing this for 30 some years, 95% of the time, maybe even more, they already know who they're after. They know the truck. They know who it is. You know, they're working a targeted operation to find the person and just catch them in the act. And that's where the decoy comes in. You know, obviously getting a law enforcement officer, the poacher, and then a wild animal to walk down the street at the same point at the same time is nearly impossible. So by using the decoy, that eliminates a lot of that. So then they just got to wait for the guy to come down the road. They have the other two elements in place. You know, I get video clips all the time from different officers of people shooting. You know, it's kind of crazy. Some of them shoot 10, 12 times at the decoy. And really, it doesn't run away. It moves, but it doesn't, you know, the head moves or whatever, but it doesn't run away. You know, you think that people catch on after a couple shots. Either they're a really bad shot or, you know, I don't know. They're not.
Well, you don't know you hit it, I guess, right?
Right, exactly, exactly.
How do the decoys hold up to being shot, as you say, maybe 10 or 12 times?
Over the years, it's amazing that we don't replace as many as you'd think we would. They last quite a long time. Actually, that officer I told you about in Oregon, Galen Chandler, did a study one time, and he averaged over a 10-year period, he thought he averaged about $30,000 in revenue off of one $2,000 decoy.
You mentioned the thermal. You got some to put out heat, the movement. It almost seems like an arms race sometimes with poachers. They figure out what's in the decoys, and they're figuring out ways to work it out, and then you're working on ways to get ahead of them.
Correct, yeah. I say it's kind of like radar detectors and police on the side of the road, you know, just a back-and-forth cat-and-mouse game.
Do you have anything more in the works? You mentioned you do some movies and TV. Anything that you've done or that you'd want to tackle a challenge?
We're working on one. I've always wanted to work on one, and we played around with it a little bit on one that has like a CO2 cartridge in its nose. So on like a cold day, it would actually poof wow. out some steam, which would be kind of cool. So right now, our thermal deer is the hot item. It's been a long time coming, and it's been a little over a year of development and trying to get it to where we want it, where we're comfortable selling it to the officers. So that they can use it and use it effectively.
And you just got back from the North American Wildlife Enforcement Officers Association conference a couple weeks back, mm-hmm. I understand. Yeah. It sounds like, are you seeing a lot more demand for these officers for the kind of work you do?
Absolutely. It's funny that you see all these shows, and we filmed with Discovery Channel probably about 8 years ago. We filmed for almost 2 years with them when those law enforcement DNR type conservation shows started coming out. But now they have them all over, you know, that Lone Star Law, and there's one in Michigan, Maine, New Hampshire. They all have TV crews that follow them around. And you'd think that business would slow down, but it's actually gotten busier over the years.
We'll leave it there. Brian, thanks so much for sharing your work with us today.
Hey, not a problem. It was fun talking with you.
Brian Walslagle is the owner of Custom Robotic Wildlife, Inc. in Mosinee. He creates robotic decoy animals for use in catching poachers. If you're going to be in the Green Bay area tomorrow morning, you can stop by for coffee with Wisconsin Today co-host Kate Archer-Kent. Kate will be at the Kavarna Coffee House from 9 to 10:30 a.m. She wants to hear from you about life in Northeast Wisconsin and your connections to your community, and you can share some local recommendations, maybe even some story ideas. It is free to attend, but space is limited, so RSVP at wpr.org/presents and say hi to Kate. Wisconsin Today producers include Avery Lee Rogers, Royce Podeswa, and Beatrice Lawrence. Our technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Sarah Hopeful. Dean Knetter is our executive producer. Tim Peterson is our managing producer. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.